Hello, kids, adults, multiforms, whatever is listening to our podcast. Maybe the government's listening to our podcast. I don't know. Probably Moffitt. Those good ideas got to come from somewhere. You're listening to the podcast with a K. Why with a K? Why not? With me today is James. Without me today is Christian. He's not here. Why isn't that? I don't know. But he's not here. Today, James and I are going to be discussing an idea brought forth to us by one of our listeners. It goes by the name of Brian Stanley. And he kicked around the idea that he would like to hear us chat about some of the best and worst ways that the doctor and friends have overcome their enemies. James, what do you think of that?
Since we only have one listener, does that mean our listener does change his name? Is this like a secret agent thing? Is it a Jekyll and Hyde sort of thing? Is it?
I think it's really kind of kind, to be honest. They're aware we have the one listener, but they don't want the audience out there to be aware of that.
And they don't think
while
they are
unaware
to,
that they are the only audience member that would be aware of that anyway.
So they don't really want us making them aware of what they're already aware that they don't want us to make them aware of.
Exactly.
I thought so. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. I like this. I like this Brian. He sounds actually, he could be a better Brian than you realize.
It's very likely.
Because he's prepared a question.
Yeah, well.
Have you prepared for an answer to this?
I prepared to read the question. That was my preparation. That was the level of skill I had for preparation.
He counters that by being prepared to write the question. So
fair
he
enough.
Sort of nullified your aptitude on that.
And, you know, I'm sure he's going to have some examples that he would like to hear us talk about.
Absolutely.
And I can only hope that you and I just happen to come up with some of those examples because I we're not prepared.
No, I'm not prepared at all.
We're prepared to dive in, though.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're not really prepared. We're forced to, really. It's sort of
fair
like...
enough.
Maybe a sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark situation where we have a stone wall pushing us, a digital wall pushing us further on through this digital podcast. I mean, we can't go backwards. We can only go forwards. So we have little choice. We can't stay where we are. Time doesn't let us. It rolls onwards for us. So, yeah. Okay, so this is an interesting question. I don't think there's anything been in the news that we need to talk about, is there, before we move on to this?
No, you know, I haven't seen anything of any importance to talk about.
I don't even go to the Cerberus place either, so I wouldn't know.
What is that anyway, Cerberus?
So old hat. I mean, who goes to websites anymore?
Right? The dying
right,
medium.
Dude. Yeah, absolutely. You listen to podcasts. You see, because Christian is away, he's unable to give us his itinerary of what he expects us to do, and of course, what we never do anyway. But nevertheless, each time, with diligent hope and aspiration for his partners, he does hope that we will actually do something useful, which of course we never do, which is cool. I saw Christian last week. I met him. First time I've actually met him. Obviously, met him digitally and orally. In both sense of the word, but not in person. And I was quite shocked at how big he was.
I was just going to say the height, right? Yeah.
Well, it's not just the height. I want to stress this. I'm not making any suggestions of weight or anything. It's just, I think when you're so used to seeing someone as a small box on your screen of about sort of between 75 by 75 pixels and 250 pixels, you don't tend to sort of get a concept of what sort of how that relatively scales into everything else in a non-digital world. And like his hands are so much bigger than mine. I noticed that when he shook my hand. I was thinking, your hands shouldn't be that big. I'd already conceived what size your hands should be. And they're not running to this preconception. So it was almost like he was closer to me than he was. That sort of foreshortening thing. Yes, he was closer to me than he actually was, because as I say, it was a bigger presence than I imagined. But yeah, it was very nice meeting, met him and his family. We had a chat and saying how nice you were as well, Brian.
Oh, well, isn't that nice? Or were you talking to Stanley?
No, he was, yes. Which one was I talking to?
The dear listener,
I think,
or the heartbroken commentator?
I think Christian would probably be more likely to be erring on the side of the listener at the moment, since the listener has done his job.
Right, thanks.
And, it's being
and we're still not, by the way.
No, we're not even on the subject yet. We're just talking about our fellow friend, who none of you care about. You know, he's a voice that you occasionally have to suffer to get your news, but that beyond that, who cares?
But it helps us. You see, the more time we waste talking about nonsense, it's the less examples we have to come up
Absolutely.
With for this.
I'm watching the clock. You're watching the clock as well. See how much time we can eat in through this.
I've got an alarm set and everything.
Let's be fair. Let's get down to this.
Yes.
Right. How are we going to do this, Brian? I think we need to pick a doctor and do it that way and narrow it down.
That's a good idea. Oh, wait. So we're only going to do it for one doctor?
No. I think just to get us rolling,
all right.
It is the question for play, you might want to call it.
I see.
Just getting ourselves greased and oiled. So let's have a think. Do we have a doctor that we would like to try?
Okay. Oof. I'm not prepared for him at all, but Pertwee is coming to mind.
Okay, you want to go with Pertwee? After Pertwee, we're going with Davison, because I think they're quite contrary sort of approaches to the doctor during the day.
Okay.
So I think that might work. So, John Pertwee. Okay, actually, fair enough. Let's just start with Spearhead from Space, because there is an interesting situation here where at the very end they have... he has his special finish the story weapon that he has created.
Right.
Neatly finish the story once it's activated. Yet he can't get it activated. There's not much luck involved, is there? Is there any luck? I don't think of this. I think they're actually fairly... because, the thing doesn't work, does it? When he confronts the Nestine and he can't get it to work.
Well, it came unplugged.
Right.
And Liz had to plug it back in to make it work. So it's not necessarily luck because
the technical requirements of a companion.
Yeah, well, yeah.
With female companion, maybe she can just about manage to plug it in for me, and then I can, yeah.
All those years of school she went to just to be the scientist that she is, and she's an expert plugger-inner.
And the worst thing is that is possibly her best episode as well. That's her aptitude.
But the good thing about it, though, is it is at least a good example of like one of the best ways, because the two of them work together as scientists to come up with this idea. You know, so it's not like it wasn't a lucky or a happenstance kind of thing. Like, yeah, sure, there was a little bit of luck for the doctor when he couldn't realize why his device wasn't working, because also he's one of the world's most genius scientists as well. And he couldn't even think, oh, is it plugged in? You know, it's like one of the first things the IT people ask you. And he didn't even think about it. But it's not really a matter of that. They thought of the way he designed this thing. Maybe she helped design this thing. I don't know. It was science and it worked. So that has to be an example of a good one.
Do you think there's going to be a lot of these in John Pertwee? The ones where I'm off the top of my head, I can think of certain situations where he was lucky, actually. One that springs to mind because I watched it not long ago was Ambassadors of Death. Where mm-hmm. he has a, where he takes the, where the bomb blows up, and he comes out with just a minor injury, a slight head injury.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking there, you know, if that had actually done what it was meant to do, that would have been the end of the show. You know, it was quite a fairly lethal device.
Sure.
That, as I recall, and you can correct me if you can recall better, should have really any other character would have killed probably, you know, any other minor character. But for him, he's lucky, and I suppose
I was going to say he did get in the TARDIS at the end, though, so perhaps that had something to do with it. Not to give it as an example of a good one, but that would probably be the only thing that saved his life.
What, an Ambassadors of Death? Did he?
Yeah. Oh no, excuse me. I'm confusing it. I'm thinking of Claws of Axos. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ambassadors of Death is where the as I recall, the scientist. Brings him. You see, this is how good we were. Not only are we unprepared, we're actually uneducated in the show. Where the scientist brings the thing, and the thing blows up, and it's meant to kill, and it doesn't. But I think what was interesting was, as the intention was, as I recall, and of course listeners can berate us for this, was to actually kill him, and it doesn't just sort of, it does what it's meant to do, but doesn't actually do it. I suppose there's things like that. I imagine what the Better Brian was talking about was more in the sort of new series, where maybe there are a few more lucky happenstances that sort of.
Well, there are, but there's at least another one in the Pertwee era that I can think of offhand, okay. Which is the Time Monster. At the end of the Time Monster, the Doctor can think of only one way to stop the Master, and that's a time rem, and it's very dangerous, and it's possibly going to kill all of them. And they decide to go for it, and then the Time Monster, I forget the name of the actual creature now, but intervenes, and Cronus. It was luck. Mm. You know? What was the name, I'm sorry?
Cronus, wasn't it?
Cronus, yes, thank you. But that's total luck. Like, the Doctor couldn't have planned for that, didn't know about that, didn't expect that. So that was a chance where, like, you know, he was prepared to do whatever it took to end this. And so it wasn't really like a big gamble that was just going to save the day. He knew it would stop the Master, but he also knew it would end the both of them.
But I suppose the situation there, you've got the good fortune that, well, not good fortune, you have a certain amount of odds. As I recall, my brain is stretching here, it's not a definitive death, it's likely. It could be a catastrophic thing, but there is a chance. Does he say there is a chance, or is it meant to be total annihilation? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember offhand either, but he did basically.
I'm sure the other Brian knows. He's probably there, yeah, listening to this, going, "Oh, for God's sake,
prepare next time, man."
I mean, one that springs to mind actually, which is probably a good example, is Ark in Space, Shifting Doctors, where the Doctor is going to kill himself. Essentially, he's going to. The releases to the rocket, he's got one left to do, and he's either hoping, he's edging his bets that the other guy is going to actually knock him out, take him aside and do the last bolt himself.
Yeah.
Or that is an issue where by good fortune he has made such an impact on the other man, the other man's willing to risk his life, well, not risk life, give his life instead of the Doctor.
But you know, now I have to wonder, are these even proper examples? Because in both situations we just mentioned there, the Time Monster and Ark in Space, the plan was set and the plan would work. We're just having these situations that saved his life, which essentially were dumb luck or self-sacrifice of somebody else.
So, I mean, in the sense, the plan, if the fact that he'd have died or someone else had died is irrelevant to the point that the day would have been saved.
Right.
It wasn't like, luck that allowed the day to be saved. It was,
yeah, so yes, rather than... True. Yeah, so rather than coming up with a device or a plan to save the day, what episodes just had some random happenstance that happened to save the day, and the Doctor was left a little bit dumbfounded, like, oh, well, glad that worked. I would have never thought of that kind of thing. And perhaps that might be a little bit more new series than classic.
Well, can you think of any in the new series which specifically do that? I mean, I suppose you could argue Kill the Moon had a bit of that.
But
I mean, that's so terrible, I don't think we should even give it the goodwill of actually being included in this podcast, so forget we said that.
Yeah, I don't know, I just, for some reason, I feel, and maybe this is where we are unprepared and should have prepared a little bit, but it has to be, there has to be something. I have this feeling that there is like a story or two out there where the Doctor had a plan, was going to do something, and something else just happened. And it's driving me nuts now, because now I can't think of any good examples. But, you know, I mean, I can think of kind of another kind of dumb luck situation in a way when the Lazarus experiment, they end up in that church.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that, you know, sonic resonance, yes, or whatever are going to be what can stop this guy. And hey, look, you just happen to be in the one place that has great acoustics and an organ, you know. And, you know, it was a little lucky of a place to end up. Otherwise, how would the Doctor have stopped him? He would have had to, like, found some kind of device to make to do that. And instead, there was a ready-made device there. So what if? He didn't go hide out in a church. What if that wasn't his big thing that he remembered? What if it was his childhood home and he went to his childhood home instead? Then, you know, the story would have needed a better resolution. It would have needed a scientific device or some other kind of trap. Like, they would have needed to lure him to the church, because maybe that, then it wouldn't have been so happenstance or lucky. The Doctor would have said, wait, acoustics, Sonics, there, that church has an organ. Let's get him in here. Let's get him to chase us in here. So maybe that's a good example of one where the writing just kind of took you to the place which was just perfect to destroy him, rather than have the doctor or the companion be the one to think, whoa, that place over there, let's get him in there.
I suppose you've got ones where the ending go against what the doctor's plan or expectations would be, in the sense of things like Dalek, where he is, the resolution of that is a surprise to the doctor. Or I suppose for an argument, you could say the Beast Below as well has a flaw that way. The companion has the moment and the doctor is wrong-footed, I suppose, is the summarisation of those two stories. Which again is sometimes a new series approach.
Also, you sort of have the Lodger too, where they kind of figure it out very last minute what the solution is. You know, they have a plan, they kind of go in half cocked, and then they kind of realize at the end there that what it is. You know, it's love that's going to save the day, essentially.
Or you've got the terrible Let's Kill Hitler, where the only person who has the plan, who not only has the plan, but has the noble sacrifice and every other Mary Sueism in there, where everyone will be in her debt, is River Song, saving the day from, I suppose, River Song, to be honest.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I suppose there are, the only one that I remember, because when this is done properly, it can be quite bold. I remember there's an episode of Space 1999, I think it's called Black Sun, where the moon, they discover the moon, which if you don't know about Space 1999, it happens in our far future in September 13th, 1999, where the moon is accidentally blasted out of orbit by a nuclear dump on the moon, which rockets it into space, which is the most absurd story really ever. And the inhabitants on the moon base go through various adventures. In one adventure, the moon is on target to a black sun, which is treated like a black hole, effectively. And they're on course, and it's about how can they get off course from this black sun that they're being pulled in through the gravity. And the story goes through various ways of them trying to escape the pull, and they can't. And then there's a nice sort of second act where they sort of, I suppose it's third act, where they sort of accept their fate. And then they go through the black sun and come out the other side okay, and travel onwards, and that's it. And that's the story. And that was actually quite bold, because it sets up all these sort of standard tropes of how are they going to get out of this? And they don't. The only thing that gets them out of this is the fact that they can go through, be it through supernatural forces or science or however you want to do it. There's an inference of supernatural forces. But that was quite bold and rare. I can't think of many instances where that's sort of really happened in Doctor Who. I mean, there's ones also where the forces are beyond the Doctor, and the Doctor sort of works out what's going on, things like Enlightenment, or maybe to a certain degree Armageddon Factor, but I'd say Enlightenment's quite a good example, where he sort of sits back in the knowledge of what he is doing needs to do with something that's far bigger than him, in a way.
Even some of those kind of dumb luck stories, they did have to take some of the character's intellect, either the doctor or the companion, to sit there and think, you know, I realize what's going on here now. You know, like even the Lodger, for example, it may have been sort of, if you will, a dumb luck situation, but more so, it didn't just happen because of dumb luck. It happened because someone figured out that that's what needed to happen. And so to say that it was just kind of dumb luck kind of thing, it was a little bit more so that you were missing either the obvious or just the solution you were thinking was a bit more technology based. We can stop this with science, when really it's not so scientific, you know. So it is a little tough to call on that, because offhand, I can't think of too many stories. Now, granted, there has to be, but I can't think of too many stories that left me with that feeling of like that was just lucky, you know.
Well, to some degree, I mean, the superior Brian has not really done himself much justice here, because he should have given us a couple of examples of what he meant, just so we would understand what he was talking about, not because we would need the examples to use as our benchmark of our inability to do any research.
Well, you do also sort of have that moment in Rose, when Rose decides to use her gymnastics training to save the doctor. But you know, not only does she actually like free the doctor from the Auton's grip, but she manages to get that vial that the other one's holding just to magically fall right into the Nestine consciousness, rather than maybe having her free the doctor and then the two of them together work to free the vial and actually purposely put it in there. It all did work out a little too perfect right there. You know, and that was all in an effort to make Rose just seem like the special companion that they wanted her to be, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree on that. That's that was very frustrating. I think these sort of things don't always have to happen at the end either. They can happen at any cliffhanger.
Sure.
Or moment, which is resolved by a bit of dumb luck.
The long game, too, is also an example of a gamble. You know, the doctor's big plan was to kind of plant the seed into, and I'm so terrible with remembering names today, but into the sorry,
yeah,
the newscaster, something.
Oh yes, Simon Pegg-Carry.
No, not Simon, no, but the, no, the woman that was the newscaster, that was all she wanted promotion so badly, her. Yes. And I apologize for forgetting the characters' names today, dear listener, as we say, but that's what's happening. But anyway, it was a good gamble. I mean, he's pretty good at reading people, so he probably just thought that was really going to happen. But that was your plan. You were banking on that person like coming up and doing the right thing, because you kind of essentially shamed them for not doing the right thing. Maybe that's not a lucky situation, but in a sense it is, because you're lucky that that person actually had some morals to pay attention to what you were saying and go ahead and do it. When really what we saw of that character, in my opinion, I would have never thought that they would have ever actually had the guts to do that, because everything I saw was, I don't really care. I want promotion. And I'm so pissed off this other person got promotion because I've worked hard. They were me, me, me. They weren't, oh, wow, you know what? I have to do the right thing here kind of person. It just didn't feel right to me.
Yeah. I mean, luck is a funny thing, isn't it? Because in some respects, if it's used in fiction, it's something you've got to be very careful, because it can pull audiences out of the drama if they feel that a hero is being kept alive or resolutions are being created by things beyond the skills of the hero. They suddenly feel the drama start to fall away from them. Yet, to be fair, you know, if you look through history, history is replete of moments where you wouldn't believe that things could coincide at the same time. As you can imagine, I have prepared no examples of this, but they, you know, it's one of the things which makes history interesting is there are things that happen which seem so serendipitous that you wouldn't imagine they would ever happen, but they do. So in a sense, you can get away with it. And I must admit, it's an interesting question, because when I watch Doctor Who or watch any science fiction or any drama, if the luck factors feel quite high, I find myself trying to have to justify them in my head by some means or another. They do actually become blocks, because they can become frustrating. The Rose one's a perfect example, because everything coordinates in that last moment so perfectly. You just think, that's not fair, because that wouldn't happen to me. I'd overshoot knocking the person and then just be swinging there for a little bit, let alone knock the file into the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think when luck is a major contributing factor, and to be honest, I don't mind the odd story where people get lucky, because sometimes it does happen. It really isn't a lot of times the best way to solve something in my mind, because I do rather, I think we've talked about this many times before, I prefer the intelligent heroes, the people who can think and work their way out of situations just by being smart, essentially, you know. And that doesn't mean that you have to be a rocket scientist. All you have to do is just be Joe Average, who can actually compute what's happening around you and figure out a good solution out of it, you know. Not every situation needs some kind of giant scientific device. Like, for instance, Rose had the only fair idea that she could in that moment. I need to physically attack these guys somehow. They're so much stronger than I. How can I do this? I'll give them the entire weight of my body thrown at them with the force of the swing, you know. And fair idea there. You know, you hopefully can hit one enough so hard that it will release the doctor. The rest of it should have happened a bit more naturally from there, rather than just everything so perfectly serendipitous. And so I agree with you. Like, when I watch and I see too many things get too lucky, you do have to kind of reconcile it. You do try and figure out, well, maybe it wasn't luck. Maybe they figured this. Maybe they thought that. Like, for instance, in Human Nature, when the doctor sees that that person is going to get, the woman and her child are going to get squished by the piano, and he takes that cricket ball. That wasn't luck. I mean, he, as the scientist, as the doctor, as the alien that he is, he figured out all of the different parameters that need to go in with that hit. You need to hit that shot. And granted, most people would say it's a lucky shot, but you certainly need to be accurate enough to start that whole chain reaction with the perfect hit. And it was a neat scene. It played out very cool because it showed that the doctor was still in that character, which removed from my eyes any kind of luck from that moment. It wasn't just like somebody just having a lucky moment. It was showing us that he's still in there, despite the fact that he's not the doctor anymore and that he's human now. The doctor is still in there trying to get out. And it certainly echoes, although it wasn't quite as fancy a shot, but it echoes the one from the Christmas Invasion when the Sycorax leader is going to attack the doctor, and he takes a Satsuma and hits the magical eject button, which is actually, there you go, that's a perfect example. At the same time, while a good example of why Human Nature worked, it's a perfect example of a dumb luck situation. You know, why was there a button there that would remove some kind of fold in the ground that you're standing on? Like, what was that thing? You know, like, it would have been helpful if they told us what it was, some kind of venting flap or, you know, a tail wing to an airplane, you know, to adjust for wind variances and so on. Like, if they had given us an idea of why this big button was there that just happened to release this area that he's standing on, it would have been a little bit better. But that's a good example of just a dumb luck thing. That guy just happened to be standing in the perfect place that the doctor realized, I can use this, but the audience had no clue.
Well, I mean, I tend to find with that, and I think this is where I found McCoy's era very good, was is that when you start to create a character which is very powerful, as Tennant mirrored, echoed McCoy, the dumb luck loses its problem, because you can actually associate virtually everything's happened becomes part of a plan that you can't see. And by plan, it can even just be, perhaps even tactics is better. You could even argue with that dumb luck situation with Tennant that he was aware of where the guy was standing and already taken that into account. And because he has such understanding of all the sort of all these sort of various crafts and ships and where things likely are, you know, because he is so much more abundantly experienced than we
are. Absolutely.
You can sort of say that before he even does that, he has that in mind. If he turns around and comes at me, I've noticed where he is. All I need to do is release the venting fin, whatever it was, and problem solved. And there is a sort of slightly ostentatious nature to the Doctor who'd enjoy that anyway, even slightly murderous.
And I will be honest, like, the luck, if you will, from that moment never detracted from that scene for me. I actually really always liked that scene. In fact, I really liked that episode. So I agree with what you're saying. Like, there's just this thing that Tennant just seems to be on in that scene. And it's kind of like what they say with spies. You know, when a spy enters a room, he's got to be aware of like 100 different things that an ordinary person, he or she, I guess I should say, have to be aware of what they see in that room that an ordinary person would just overlook. You know, they walk into a room and they can spot, the people who look shady. They can see the coffee cups, weapons, certain things that they may be able to use to their advantage for a necessary escape. So when Tennant got out there on that ship's edge, he probably looked at every inch of that area and just realized where he was. Hell, he realized what blood control was the second he saw the device. So he's got to know what else about their ship. So in some instances, perhaps some people are looking at some of these things as dumb luck and forgetting that the characters may have some experience. Like, for instance, the doctor's daughter. It's not necessarily a dumb luck situation, but a lot of people always talk about how Donna was able to put together those dates, the archiving system. You know, and they were like, wow, she really kind of pulled that one out of her butt, you know. But it's like, well, she had so much experience as a temp, as an archivist and so on. It makes sense. Yeah, it seems a little tough for me because I can't sit there and see how she was making sense of those numbers. But she could, because she had the experience to do so, and it made sense and it worked for the story, even if we can't in reality make sense of those numbers ourselves. I don't see that as a dumb luck. I do see it as something that they could have played up a little bit more prior to that episode, but we did have all the information that we did need. So it's not really a bad situation when you really watch it.
the beauty of the new series is you also have this assertion which came from the books, really, that, you know, that because he's a time traveler, that he sees things in different ways. So, like, for instance, in the Christmas Invasion, you could almost sort of suggest he's as someone who's part of time, maybe, because we even get the insertion in Waters of Mars, where he sees bits of the future, the time changing. He's that sort of connected to it. Maybe he sees flashes of how the ship works, you know, in different periods, you know, fins being vented, you know, how far does his intellect to his position as a Time Lord actually merge and be one and the same? And the same thing, another one of it is like, someone could say, like in Utopia, the end of Utopia, he's very lucky that he's got Jack along with him, who had jumped on board the TARDIS, to have a vortex manipulator to get them out of the situation at the end. But then you'd say, well, you could also argue it was pretty bloody unlucky that he ended up at the end of the universe with having his TARDIS nice and open for the Master to steal.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, luck can swing both ways. It can, you know, you can be horrendously lucky and you can be horrendously unlucky, because there's only one person who could take the TARDIS virtually in the whole universe, bar Riversong, who hadn't been created yet.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing with that, too, is that the Doctor wouldn't have found himself all the way at the end of the universe, because by his own admittance, they generally avoid that time. And they only arrived there anyway because of the guy with the vortex manipulator.
Absolutely.
So yeah. Essentially, it's lucky situations, but also situations that do at the same time even make sense.
I think the thing with Doctor Who is that the lucky situations compared to most dramas are less, because the main character is so powerful, if you see what I mean. I mean, if you look at Torchwood, I'm sure you'll probably find far more examples, if I'd researched it, of where good fortune or positions of serendipity are more abundant, because you've got characters that don't have that almost godlike ability to turn situations around.
Yeah, well, you know, and one other thing I realized too was you were making a good point about how the Doctor sees things in different ways, which is something we can't forget, because it's mentioned quite often enough. It's certainly mentioned even in Eccleston's first episode.
Yeah.
But take for example the end of the world. You know, when he's trying to cross that bridge to get to that unit to turn things off, you have a couple things that are happening there. You have one really stupid thing and one really brilliant thing. And the brilliant thing you kind of couldn't have had, unfortunately, in that episode without the stupid thing. And the stupid thing is, who in their right mind would build a ship where the fans spin that low to the only bridge you have to cross to the cutoff switch? You know, it's just ridiculous. That wouldn't happen, you know, so the Doctor got put in a situation that shouldn't have happened just because it should have never been designed that way. It's just completely asinine. It's like that joke that was made in Galaxy Quest, when they have to cross like into the main engine of the ship and they have to walk past all those gigantic clamps. And it's like, well, people got to come down there and fix that stuff. You're telling me that they always got to like dance around those clamps? I mean, that's just ridiculous, you know? But the brilliant moment that you have is it gives us one of the, I don't want to say one of the first glimpses, but one of the best glimpses of the Doctor being able to see the universe in ways that we can't, but by essentially tuning himself in to time there and those blades and realizing the exact moment he could step through without being torn apart by the blade, which I think is a fantastic moment. And I do wish that there was maybe a better reason for it, as like maybe the fan blades themselves, the struts that they were on or something, had come loose and they broke free and lowered down to that area, and maybe it was just not a good situation because the ship was in so much danger, rather than just a bad human design, you know. But it's a very good example there of how he sees things, and some could say, wow, what a lucky thing, but it was more unlucky that someone would have designed that ship that way and that script just to give him such a great moment, which is both cool and ridiculous at the same time.
This takes us down to a different, very, very common argument about people who like the Lonely God and those who like the Wandering Fool. You know, and I think there's good arguments for both sides. And in a sense, it links back to your recommendation last week with the Superior Spider-Man. The assertion that, you know, if the Spider-Man lets himself go, he can, the Spider-Man, if the Spider-Man can let himself go, he's potentially far greater if he does it, but he reins himself in. And you could almost, and you get that with the Doctor, and Waters of Mars is a very, very excellent example of that, where you get this feeling that the Doctor constantly reins himself in. A lot of these situations, perhaps he could actually sort out a lot quicker, but there are certain rules and limits that he has to work within. And then again, this sort of makes the Lux scenarios far less problematic, because you've got a character that maybe could sort things out in different ways. But, and you could perhaps even argue Kill the Moon on this as well. There are certain either ideological or time laws which he would prefer to sit, be framed around when dealing with these. In the same way, I suppose you could say that there's an old lady who has a problem. I'm trying to think of a good analogy, but and I can't. But you know, there are certain ways of dealing with problems which we as people would consider too brutal. That, you know, if an old lady's ill, for instance, you could try and save her and try and elongate her life and give her a few more extra weeks, or you could just kill her and then the problem's solved, you know, and then she's no longer in pain. You know, there's, but you wouldn't do the pain, you wouldn't do that, because we have a moral objection to that, while we would probably want to try and extend her life for a couple of weeks if we could, because that's how we think, that's how we morally like to work. So, you know, maybe that's the factor, is that he could be a lot more powerful, powerful than we actually see. But as we say, that these limits, and there are sort of almost like more sort of moral or ideological limits to how time functions that he won't break. Not so much that he's worried about Time Lord looking over his shoulder, but in the same way we would have a moral issue with killing someone to alleviate them from pain. Okay, I know that in itself can be a big argument itself, but let's just simplify it for a moment. No one wants to do that, even if people will feel morally obliged to do it. It's not something people like to do. We're taught killing is bad. Maybe there's that sort of factor to him. So once you start embroidering the character with all these extra things about them, not only does it sort of make them more interesting, but it does also help in these catch-em situations where you're trying to find ways of justifying some of his successes, where maybe occasionally he does actually know a little more than he should, and we don't see it, but it sort of helps get around them.
No, that's a very good thought, because I mean, like you said, with the Superior Spider-Man kind of similarities, you have not only the things that he feels he shouldn't do because they transcend the laws of time, and you know the Time Lords aren't there anymore. He's got to be the one to watch out for that. And we certainly saw the effects of one of those in Father's Day, when Rose kind of ignored what the Doctor knew would happen if she had contact with her younger self, physical contact with her younger self. So there are things like that, but not only that, you do still have, even still keeping in with the Superior Spider-Man connection, is just the moral dilemma. You know, Peter Parker knows I can stop this bad guy with one punch, but if I do that, I might break his skull, and that's a really bad situation for that guy, and I don't want to be responsible for his death or, you know, his life being completely altered due to my actions. And the Doctor has those same ramifications. I mean, we see that with him. He generally only will kill, and usually not by picking up a gun and just shooting someone, although it unfortunately has been known to happen. But he will set events in motion which will kill the bad guy, because he knows it's the only way to actually stop them. But if there is another way, he'll try that first. So unfortunately, some innocents die because the Doctor has the moral dilemma of, I can stop this, I can kill this person right now, but there has to be another way. And if he didn't always try and look for that other way, then the situations, the episodes would be over much sooner. And maybe, go on.
Maybe there's an even more sort of oblique sort of morality there, that we don't have a sort of more alien morality, in the same way that, I mean, if you see the world as history, if history becomes manifest, maybe to a certain degree there is almost like a distasteful morality is probably the wrong word, there's a sort of distaste in actually brutalizing it. So to actually solve a problem by using brutal temporal or alien, and by alien I mean like him being alien to time, being a temporal being, a Time Lord sort of slightly divorced from it, that would feel distasteful to him, in the same way, I suppose, as going into a playground and going and beating up children for sweets. You wouldn't want to do that. You would feel uncomfortable doing that. even if one of the kids was a particularly bullish kid, you wouldn't want to go and sort of hurt him. You might want to try and stop him by some more subdued ways, but ultimately you could have gone in there and just picked him up and thrown him into a cardboard box, like the Incredible Hulk or, you know, whatever. So maybe there's also that fact to the Doctor.
Sure.
That if, you know, everyone is so much below him, there is a feeling of moral responsibility that comes from his race. Not to intervene just simply because of the, you know, threat of the, you know, a policeman coming by and telling you you shouldn't go and be nasty to kids, but just simply because you're brought up, you don't want to be nasty to kids. You know, there's a bully in the playground, you want to sort the bully out without making the bully suffer. And that's the why reason you don't want to make the bully suffer, not because you, or hopefully not, because you're scared a policeman might stop you. So maybe that's a lot of what it is. The Doctor doesn't want to overtly, crassly deal with the problems with these smaller, lesser races. He's more concerned of that than he is of a Reaper coming by, even though the Reaper would be bad, very bad. It's not about the repercussions. It's about that social responsibility as a Timeless. I don't know.
No, I can certainly understand that. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it still falls under the whole moral, moral dilemma aspect.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is great, and it's one of the great things about that character and many characters like him, which I always like. You know, that's the whole, you know, using your brains instead of weapons kind of aspect that I always like, and it falls under there. But it does make a lot of sense, especially if you are trying to set an example for those humans or those beings that you travel with that may not have that kind of understanding that you do have. What we've got here, though, is it seems like while there are a few perhaps lucky situations that we could think of right now, most of them kind of have some merit that we can at least understand how they came about, or rather than just being complete left field. Now, granted, there's some Mary Sues, and we have to understand that, like, River Song was a Mary Sue, and Moffat's era might have more than we're, either of us are thinking of. I personally don't know it quite as well as I know the rest, but I remember being upset with some of his story endings because fixes came out of left field. But it does seem like a lot of the lucky things that we can think of at least have merit. But how about situations now, since they wanted us to talk about both the good and the bad? What's an example of one of the best resolutions, or at least a well thought of resolution that you can think of?
Oh, that's a good question, isn't it? And one that I have utterly unprepared for.
Well, okay, I do have one, and it's not even a huge one, but it's a story that I love personally, and it's something that to me shows the Doctor's intelligence and understanding of alien races for a way to actually end the situation that's happening. While at the same time, it does sort of have, if you will, almost a lucky aspect to it, in that he's lucky that his plan worked to stave off further invasions of the Earth. And the story I'm talking about is the Santarin experiment.
Yeah.
What I like about that is he realized, okay, we can gain access to the Santarin ship, to Steyr's ship. We can go ahead and stop him. All we have to do is one of you go in the ship, steal basically his food source, if you will, which is something that he needs in regular intervals, and I'll tucker him out. And once we do, we've got him. He can't stop us. And essentially, it's no different than taking prisoners of war and starving them, because you know that the more you starve them, the weaker that they're going to get, that their chances of escape are far less, you know. And it just happened, obviously, because it's an alien race, it happened within the span of minutes rather than months. But I liked it because it showed the Doctor's intelligence and understanding of these creatures and their spaceship. The luckiest aspect of it is that when he talks to the general, and he basically tells him that the invasion failed, which was a one-man invasion force, really just a scientific test on humans. An invasion, by the way, I feel the need to say, of a barren planet with no life on it. But they're lucky that the general, rather than being the warlike alien race that they are, seeing it as an act of war and saying, we're coming for you, they were just like, oh, well, damn, he got us. I guess we won't come on back. So it's an example in my mind of both a good situation, like a good resolution, because the Doctor was very clever there and his companions helped out immensely with that. But then it's also a slight lucky one, because as the Doctor often does, he fixes the situation at hand. and then leaves, not realizing that the ramifications of what he had just done, or further ramifications of the people that you just stopped, might be possible and might come back to haunt you or this world.
But then that could be, again, an example of the playground syndrome, where, you know, you intervene as much as you can, but, you know, you haven't got the right to start going and meddling with other parents. Oh, God, I don't know how I phrase this. You haven't got the right to sort of to meddle with the welfare of other people's kids.
Sure.
So it could be a bit like that. I mean, I was thinking one of the worst examples of the application of luck, which is an application which isn't really suggested in the script. It's just what I think the viewer reads into it, is in Evolution of the Daleks, where the Doctor does a long soliloquy sort of thing, well, not soliloquy, long monologue, in front of all four Daleks, and none of them shoot him.
Yeah.
Which I find really hard to comprehend quite why not one of them's base programming just thinks at some point, he's not even hiding, he's just standing in front of us, and we're all weaponized. There's no reason to keep him alive at this point. And he has no reason to think they'll keep him alive at this point. So, I mean, how do you get around that? The only way I could sort of get around it is perhaps going back to this whole idea that apparently that perhaps the Doctor sees temporal echoes and knows that he can go and do that one moment free from being shot because he can see it in his head, you know. All the chances of it, or that timeline going that way, have probabilities. It's a high probability that they won't. I don't know, but that's a really bad one.
I was going to say the only thing that I can see about that story, and there's kind of like two aspects to it here, is you've got the Doctor facing the Daleks that were designed to think outside the box. Maybe rather than just sit there and say, okay, we heard what you had to say, exterminate you, or I'm going to exterminate you before I've heard what you had to say. Maybe it's just ingrained in them to consider actions before they just go ahead and exterminate.
Yeah.
That said, there's examples of that all throughout Doctor Who with the Daleks. If you're the Doctor and the Companion, let me say this another way. If you're not the Doctor and Companion, the chances that you're going to get exterminated on site are extremely high. If you're the Doctor and the Companion, the chances that you're going to be taken captive or somehow be able to talk your way out of the situation are also real high, you know? And yeah. And the only time that that's an exception is when they need one of the characters from the particular story to also be taken captive. So that to me, I agree, it still should fall, technically, since it is story-wise, it should fall under the whole dumb luck situation. It was just dumb luck that these creatures that are hell-bent on killing everything didn't kill you because you must have just said the right words. But at the same time, it should also fall under like inconsistent writing or inconsistent characterization, possibly.
No, I agree. I mean, I was going to say one of my favorite ones, I think, is one that I don't think a lot of people actually understood or misread. I know I didn't understand it when I was young and I first saw it, was The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. Where you get the sort of playoff at the end is that the Doctor knew exactly what was going on the whole time. But it's never really overstated, the whole thing, you know, because you go through this whole adventure and it feels as if he's not quite sure what's going on until he meets the gods of Ragnarok, which he deals with a fair amount of skill, which seems a little at odds with where he was before. And then there's a line at the end, and I can't remember what it is. It's well after he comes out of the tent and he's talking to Ace. So you just get the feeling that he knew what he was doing from the start, and it seemed a very smart way of playing the ultimate puppeteer without, as they'd done in the previous adventures of that series in Silver Nemesis and Remembrance of the Daleks, made it clear throughout that he had a good idea what was going on.
Yeah.
Greatest Show, it feels like he doesn't until the end, where suddenly, once he's defeated, and you have that lovely shot of him walking out the tent as well with the explosion behind him, that the real person is back again, that he is no longer needs to pretend, problem solved. I'm not saying he knew definitively who the problem was there, but he had a good idea that there was a problem to sort, that this wasn't just an innocent wonder to a circus.
He is a really good example, though, too, of, I don't want to say luck, but of, luck is absolutely wrong here, excuse me, of somebody who is good at quick thinking. Because while you have that story, and like you said, essentially Remembrance of the Daleks, you get a good idea that he knew what was going on the whole time. And while with The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, you kind of don't until the end. which were great different ways to play the same coin, essentially, same side of the coin. You have other stories like, say, Curse of Fenric, where maybe things got a little out of hand and he had to kind of rework his plan a little bit, but then found other ways to kind of still make it work to his advantage. But you still kind of have a sense that maybe he knew it was going to go that way, or that him being the master plotter planner that he was, he essentially realized, these are some variables that could happen and maybe plan for them. But what I do like is that you get certain stories where, you know, the rug is pulled out from underneath him and he's got to figure out what to do with it from there.
Yeah. I think that's what's good. Because as soon as you, I mean, people say, oh, I hate the Lonely God. But the beautiful thing about the Lonely God is that it does set up a very character intensive sort of show where it's less about whether he can fix things, but how he fixes things and what are the repercussions of, to him personally, of fixing things in the way that he does them. Curse of Fenric obviously being an example of McCoy's one, where he's put into a situation he wasn't expecting at the end, where he needs to use his companion to defeat the creature, which he obviously doesn't want to do, but he still does it. And that sort of weakens their relationship a little bit by the end of the story. And that's where it sort of works, where, and the book's obviously played on this a lot, how far can you push people before what you do turns them away or leaves you without being able to really truly connect to people. And I've always liked that. I do like the Wanderer as well. I think the Wanderer can be very invigorating when they don't know what's going to happen when they leave the TARDIS. And I think it's always a shame that they didn't do enough of those with McCoy. But then, as we've said before, that is the danger when you give someone full control of their TARDIS, is that it becomes more of a scene hopper than an adventurer Kickstarter.
Yeah, you know, and it's one of those character aspects too that I agree. It's really nice. It works really well when he is kind of in control and he isn't aware. But it also works really well when he is that wanderer. And
yeah,
I don't know how many of them really were able to pull off both, because they're. I'm struggling here, but I know there's an example of another doctor who has wandered into a situation that knew full well what was going. Oh, excuse me. The Invasion of Time. The fourth doctor is usually just the wanderer. He's usually somebody who gets swept up by the Time Lord, sent somewhere, and has no idea what he's got to deal with, or he just blunders into places. But that one is a good example of he was the only one who knew what was going on, which obviously also explained his erratic behavior. But even then was thrown a little bit of a curveball at the end of that story, and he turns back into the aimless wanderer as well, who had to do the quick thinking to save the day. You know, so there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a lot of good examples of how, you know, to be honest, we've talked a lot about how the Doctor has saved the day or was smart. And I know that we're really running short on time, but is there an example of a companion aside from Rose and her swing that maybe did something that was just complete dumb luck, or maybe even did something that was just completely brilliant that we can throw out there?
Well, I mean, the one that has been sitting on the edge of my lips, tongue, teeth, mouth, face has been, for various reasons, has been Earthshock for Adric saving the day inadvertently.
Yeah.
Arguably dumb luck or part of history, however you want to look at it, and the inability of the Doctor to. And I think that's probably something that Doctor Who doesn't do enough, is that if you want to play the Doctor as a powerful character, then the fragility that comes with that, the times where he cannot be as powerful as he wants to be for whatever reason, can be very dramatic. But maybe because they aim at a lot of kids, they don't want to go that far. It doesn't mean killing off every companion, but I think that was a wonderful example. Not only gave you repercussion to what they, to the adventure, but it gave a vulnerability to the crew, which, if you're going to have a very powerful character like the Doctor, can be something very potent. But yeah, so that was a companion one where I think, wow, you know, the companion does essentially steal the story there, and in a very British way as well. So far as his death. Is not intended. It's not like he goes out intentionally with a bang. Well, he does go out with a bang, but there's no intended sacrifice. And then you just have to have this moment where he has to acknowledge that he's screwed up, And he's not going to get the resolution that he wants either. He's not even going to find out the answer to the problem. Which is a terribly British way of doing science fiction. I suppose, what other ones are there?
I'm feeling terrible for not even having an example yet. I know there's
for me,
plenty.
For companions, it's Ian Chesterton, as we've said a thousand times, who has some wonderful moments. I mean, it's not necessarily the end resolution, although he does have a very key part to play in the end resolution. But there's obviously the very famous dead planet turnabout scene in about episode 5, I think it is, where he obviously ignites the fury of the Thals, where the doctors, you know, and Barbara.
Sure, yes.
And that's a beautifully powerful companion piece because it doesn't feel like he is having to upstage the doctor by having to prove a sort of superhero humanity, which is so often the way, where the companion proves their worth by doing something that feels beyond what humans would do, which is often like confronting something like the devil or confronting a load of Daleks or telling off a planet. You know, things that show how amazing this human is, rather than doing something which is just honestly human. And what Ian Chesterton does there is manipulative. It doesn't have any particular moral righteousness to it. He manipulates someone into getting so protective that they lose control. And but that is something that people can do. And I think that's what makes it such a powerful moment. It feels like a person moment. Forget human. It feels like a person moment. And without that, the doctor would have been stuck. So I like that. So that's a good one.
Yeah, no, that's a very good example. And, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's a cheat, but in a sense, as I've always said, Ian is generally more the doctor character that we know today in the first season or the first era of Doctor Who than the doctor actually is. And granted, when Ian leaves, the doctor picks up that mantle and starts to become the one that we know. But generally, the doctor is the one who got us into the situations. And Ian, more often than not, kind of found the solution or was the hero aspect, the moral center, I guess, if you will. And not to downplay Barbara or Susan in that respect, because they both had their moments, of course. But Ian definitely was the base. Like, you merge the first doctor and Ian together and you kind of get what he has become toward the end of his era. It's a shame, and I so many of these stories are so good, and I'm trying to think of a good example. You've certainly nailed two examples for me there, you know, and I feel like I'm coming
well, I
up
mean,
short
I mean,
on
there's
that.
Some, there's some great resolution moments for. I mean, Ace has quite a few. I mean, they're not necessarily end game moments, but they're moments where the companion takes control in a way where they take control of the episode. Do they feel like their little new series? They are moving towards new series moments. I mean, like, for instance, she has no fear of the Daleks, which, you know, is a dangerous thing to do, because you need companion, you need people to fear the Daleks to make sure the audiences fear these rather obvious wood plastic pieces of prop. But it is a great moment when she takes on the Dalek in the lab and does something which the main character plays the Ian in a lot of ways. Okay, so a lot of an exaggerated Ian in that scene. But she does something you couldn't have the Doctor do, which I think is actually, you can see we're improvising, is what's really interesting is when you get the companion right, is when the companion does something the Doctor can't do. And that doesn't happen enough in the new series. The new series is always about showing how the companion can do the same as the Doctor or as good as the Doctor. So she or he, or obviously normally she, can have that monologue of righteous morality or power that can save the day like the Doctor would do. And that's obviously the playoff joke in the Christmas Invasion where the Rose tries to do that and she can't. But where it's good is where the companion does what the Doctor can't do, like Ace does the action thing. Because you could not have McCoy's Doctor whacking in a Dalek, running down the stairs, and then getting trapped. It just wouldn't feel like him in the same way that Hartnell's Doctor couldn't do the bits that Ian does. So there's a sort of compatibility there. They function as a team rather than functioning as the same person.
Yeah,
so,
same thing with Troughton and Jamie as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, yeah. That's yes, absolutely.
You know, and it's interesting you brought up Christmas Invasion, because I was just going to bring that one up again real quick. But not only that, I was going to bring up the Christmas Invasion, the Last of the Time Lords, and Flatline. Because in all three of those stories, you have the companion acting without the doctor to try and save the day. All three of them are essentially removed from the doctor. Now, granted, in Flatline, Clara has more access to the doctor than the other two did. But they were all stories where they were supposed to be taking up the doctor's mantle.
But that's it. They are playing, essentially. They are taking up the mantle role because the doctor is out of action.
Right.
Rather than acting like people.
Well, and yeah, but at the same... isn't it? Well, yes, but at the same time, you kind of have an interesting level with those three characters. Because let's go in reverse. You have Clara, who becomes the doctor. They even call her the doctor in the story because she's become the doctor. She knows exactly what he would do and for the most part seems to understand nearly everything as well. You know, I think she's the one who's the most unrealistic. She's come too far. It doesn't make sense. I mean, to understand that maybe he would take extreme leaps and bounds, bringing up again the X-Files like Scully did when Mulder went missing. She had to finally admit, yes, I have believed in these things. I've just been suppressing that to try and keep Mulder at bay and myself even at bay. You know, you have an understanding that Scully decided to take these massive leaps and bounds just because she knew I need to keep the X-Files open to find Mulder. You know, that she took those extreme courses, even though she may not have believed in everyone or even been able to justify everyone, it worked. Whereas with Clara, it just seemed like, you know, Capaldi needed a day off and they were like, well, guess what? We'll just have Clara do his lines. You know, it seemed to not work for me. Whereas yeah. If you go back to The Last of the Time Lords, you have Martha using a device that the doctor rigged up so that she can travel in safety. And her job was to go around and do the very human thing of telling people about this other person who's so important and making them believe it. Now, it's still bigger than life kind of thing, but what it is it took a person with dedication and true belief to actually make enough people believe in hope because of her word about this person. And granted, they all had to synchronize their watches and do it at the same time, but it's actually, to me, it's a little bit more interesting because here she goes and she takes an entire year when her family are in danger, her best friend is in danger, and you know, she has to go around and basically be a Jehovah's Witness for the doctor and try and get people to actually believe her. But it's the conviction in her voice and the emotions that she can convey that brings it across. And she doesn't really do anything really doctorish. She lies to the master. She lies to his cohorts about a secret weapon, which is a good bluff. But it actually, I will say, it works. But it's still a little on the extreme side, whereas you get to Christmas Invasion and you have Rose. And the thing that I always loved about the Christmas Invasion with Rose is that, you know, for the first season of Doctor Who, we joked that it was Rose Who, because Rose kept saving the day. She kept coming to and doing that thing that needed to be done. And you know, the doctor was teaching her, or he was just impressed by her. Think what you want. Either way works. But then you get to this story. There's no doctor. She doesn't know what to do. She's out of her element. She knows we got to protect him. She knows we got to stand up to the bad guys. And essentially, she's doing her own, holding her own, I guess, rather, by bluffing them for a little bit and hoping beyond hope that the doctor will come back to life. And it's the most realistic situation to me, because you have somebody who couldn't possibly stop these aliens, doesn't have the knowledge to stop these aliens, and doesn't have the history or the weight behind her that the doctor does to even become a threat to these aliens. Yet she does the most human thing possible, which is try to protect her family and her friends by standing up to them, you know, which is a very brave thing to do. And I think it's the most realistic response that you can get, because you can take any companion and put them in Rose's situation right there. And that is how they should work. The only one who probably would have a better chance, I guess, maybe two people, if you really want to throw let's say three. If you want to throw Riversong and Jack with their experience in there, fine, maybe. But I think Romana has more of a chance because she's got more of the understanding of those things and the science behind her. Other than that, you can take any companion and they should all be reacting the way that Rose is, with varying different degrees of confidence or understanding, certainly. You know, and once upon a time, that would have been Ian's job. You know, and certainly talking your way out of something almost would have been enough, or getting people to revolt against them would have been enough. But even Ian in this particular situation would have been over his head. You know, so you have those three situations where you see that you can take it too far. You can get there middling where you can think this works. I can buy this. This works. Or you can get there where it's like, you know what? This makes a whole hell of a lot of sense. We actually get two examples, two really good examples in my mind of seeing what the world would be like if the companions didn't have the Doctor. And that's Christmas Invasion and Turn Left. And not to downplay them as humans, but what's great about it is you go back to that lonely God situation and you realize that the Doctor isn't like us. He's just not one of us. He can do all of these things that we can't. He has this knowledge that we don't. He can make some of these things happen greater. And he can teach us a better way to live our lives. He can teach us a better moral compass, and he can show us our true potential and the things that we can do. But there are just certain things that we're never going to overcome. And maybe those things are going to turn out to look lucky when the Doctor does it, or when they happen for him, or maybe they're going to turn out to look planned when he does them. But in reality, it's just he's got a different understanding. He's got a different experience level that we just haven't reached. And we can only try to achieve there, and not to downplay Rose in that story, because I think what they did was brilliant with her. They showed her use what she had learned to that point and what she believed in at that point. And, you know, the only other way that she could have done something better is if somehow she had had an info dump from the Doctor's mind, all of his knowledge and understanding of the universe, you know, and that was great. So I think that's kind of the main thing is that while some of these things can be lucky and some of them can be planned, there's other variables at stake when you have a science fiction TV show in the realm of this one, where understanding is kind of oftentimes outside of our own realm of understanding, because the science in Doctor Who just doesn't make a lot of sense. The reality of Doctor Who doesn't make a lot of sense. If you put these similar situations in a reality-based TV show set in our life right now, a lot of those situations would seem a whole heck of a lot more lucky than they do in Doctor Who, I think.
That's brilliant. I like the way you brought it all the way back to the lucky factor for the end. I think that's a nice dovetailing. Makes us look almost professional. That's a great point, actually, on the companions. We're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid. Brian, we don't have time for recommendations. I'm sorry.
Oh, really, that's terrible. I know.
We recommend that you listen to any of the episodes that we've talked about this week, and then we recommend that you post comments on, let us know what you think on this subject. It's a very interesting subject. Christian will be back next week. I'm going to have to rush because I think we're really running out of time. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening, or every one of the one of you. And thanks, Brian, for the – not you. Thanks, Brian, for the question.
And please send in more, anybody. That was a fun thing to do.
Absolutely. Okay, well, enjoy yourselves. Have a great week.
The Podcast of the Kid with Christian Holler, James McLean, and Brian Terranova. Thank you.